I can't fight this feeling any longer. Yet I'm still afraid to let it go.
So anyway.
I was doing my REO Speedwagon. I don't know if that will like enhance your life in any way, shape, or form.
Well, REO Speedwagon didn't the first time around, so a poor karaoke version probably won't either.
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we explore the celebrated and not-so-celebrated runs and story arcs from the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and joining me, as always, is Mr. Brian K. Reese.
I'm Brian.
Yes, he is. Again, with the banter.
I'm Brian.
On today's program, we'll be discussing the 1974 Steve Englehart run of Captain America and the Falcon, known as the Secret Empire. But before we get into that, I want to talk about some recent news in the comic book world. The first thing I want to talk about is that HBO has announced a possible Watchmen series. So it's not clear whether this is going to be an adaptation of the original comic by Alan Moore, or if it will be a spinoff, you know, a before Watchmen type of thing.
Right. There's no we have no information. Zero. It should be noted that it's Damon Lindelof doing it.
I was going to note that eventually. okay, let's start with that. What do you feel about David Lindelof?
I mean, I'm one of the people out there who did not watch Lost.
Oh, okay.
So didn't watch Lost. I know that it exists. I know that it is a thing. I know people are very passionate about the entire series. They're very passionate about the ending. But I also know that Brian K. Vaughan was involved at some point, which is always a plus.
Yeah.
But I don't have a strong opinion on Damon Lindelof. He's written some funny books here and there, none of which stood out to me, even in that I could name them. Mm-hmm. I know DC tried to bring him in a little bit at some point. I think he even maybe had a Vertigo series, or if not a Vertigo series, he wrote something in those lanes. But, you know, I don't have a hate or love for Damon Lindelof.
Well, I am one of those people who watched Lost and thought it was very, very good. I enjoyed Lost quite a bit. As far as the ending is concerned, I'm one of the few people that said, that's fine. You know, I don't care. It ended it off. It tied up some loose ends. It had some pretty interesting philosophical ideas that I appreciated. It's like, okay, that was pretty cool. But then there was there's that visceral hate on the internet.
Right.
People just get so angry. And I was like, it's a TV show. It's fine.
It ended. People are going to hate, there's no ending that will satisfy, right? I mean, and I'm talking out of school because I don't know, like, the investment that folks had in Lost. But what I do know is that there were people who were very upset, and there was, you know, because the internet is all about hating stuff. So,
yeah, well, I do think a part of it is, and Lindelof is partially to blame for this, where they constantly said, oh, we got a plan. You're going to love it. It's going to be fantastic. And you know what? It just seems like they had a plan, but they didn't have it wasn't a concrete plan. They were making shit up as they went along, which is, again, it's fine. It's a TV show.
It's fine.
Fine. Yeah. It was entertaining. I enjoyed it. I watched it every week and said, this is fun. And that's TV. That's what a TV show is. This is fine.
Well, it's sequential entertainment.
Yeah. And, you know,
I mean, the whole point of what we're doing is, I mean, we're talking about a medium that is sequential.
Right.
About entertainment. And it is about kind of changing stuff up now and again.
Yeah. So I don't have that hatred of Lost. I enjoyed Lost quite a bit. What does throw me off, and have you ever watched The Leftovers? He was also the showrunner of The Leftovers, an HBO show.
No.
I've kind of lost track of it in final seasons. Uh-huh.
Well done, Mr. Carr.
Unintentional. So I watched the first two seasons, and they were good. And then I've moved on with other things. So those are good. Those are good examples of Lindelof. He also wrote Prometheus and Star Trek in the Darkness and Tomorrowland, which were all stinkeroos. So
What, you didn't like Into the Darkness?
I am Khan. No, I didn't like that.
All right.
Like, if you're going to make Wrath of... just don't make Wrath of Khan. Just do something new and different. You know why Wrath of
Khan... Wrath of Khan.
Yes,
they were introducing Khan.
Look, no, they were... What do you mean they weren't doing Wrath of Khan? They had one guy dying... Oh, come on. It was Wrath of Khan reversed.
I don't know.
Yeah, it was. Look, the whole point of Wrath of Khan is when Spock died... And Kirk, and they have that little touching moment, you know, when the glass barrier, and they hold up, I am
and will always be your friend.
Yes. Yes. The reason that works is because
I may have gotten that quote wrong, so pardon me, quote Nazis. Yeah.
But the reason that works is that these two characters have a history. They've known each other for 20 plus years, and they actually care about one another. And that's a touching, touching moment. In the new movie, they've known each other for what? A few months, and they don't really like each other, and then suddenly you're supposed to thrust them into this touching moment. They're playing on the fact that people know what Star Trek is, but they didn't actually build the new universe. That's annoying to me. You can't tell a story on nostalgia. You can use nostalgia in order to enhance a story, but you have to tell the story first.
Oh, I think you can absolutely tell a story on nostalgia. Have you seen a World War II movie recently?
Well... Well, and anyway, I thought Star Trek Into Darkness was lazy writing and was rather, it was subpar.
Okay.
All right. So anyway, that's my feeling on Damon Lindelof is he's hit or miss for me.
Okay.
He can do things that I'm really impressed with. And then some things that I think, you know, he shit out in the night and wiped it on the walls. So how's that for a metaphor, people? So Zack Snyder will not be involved in this.
Well, and some folks feel that that is a good thing. I mean, I think although Zack has engendered some sympathy recently, which is fine. But yes, it's not Zack Snyder.
No.
And I think, I mean, why not do Watchmen? Yeah. And you're giving it to HBO, right? So HBO is HBO, you know. Mm-hmm. We'll definitely get some wiener. We'll get some naked folks. Right?
Well, the Zack Snyder movie had blue wiener everywhere.
Right.
As well. You know, it's going to be HBO money. So HBO, with an HBO budget, that means you can get to see things like a giant space squid, for instance. You know, so they'll be able to do things in the series and expand more in the series and get more deeper into the comic that the movie was not able to do.
Possibly.
Yeah.
So I mean, we don't even know, like, what the structure of the show is.
No. Yeah. Yes.
What we know is that we don't even know if it will come to pass. What we know is right now that HBO is talking to Damon Lindelof about doing a Watchmen series. So the question we should ask ourselves is, outside of wieners and boobs, which are important things, and I think we should always be concerned with wieners and boobs, but...
There's a tagline for the show right there.
Yes.
Always be concerned with wieners and boobs. Wieners
and boobs.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the collected edition, Wieners and Boobs.
Wieners and Boobs. But what we know is that HBO, a channel that has a... mixed history with presenting certain shows. We have great shows on HBO. We have adaptations on HBO. We have terrible adaptations on HBO.
Yeah. I think
what we know is that HBO allows for a lot of freedom.
And I think on the whole, HBO does quality programs. And
generally, yes.
Generally. And, you know, they're looking for that next big thing to fill the Game of Thrones-shaped hole that's going to appear in a couple of years.
Right.
So I think a dark postmodern deconstruction of the superhero genre might be the ticket. I mean, it has a lot of potential, is what I'm saying.
I think it has a lot of potential. I think that there are folks out there who have their underpants all in a bunch in general about Watchmen being sacrosanct. The idea that no one is allowed to touch Watchmen and Watchmen is untouchable and should exist as it is in a strange void. And that just seems crazy to me.
It doesn't matter. If someone makes a movie and you don't like it, that doesn't mean that the comic ceases to exist.
Exactly.
The comic is the comic, and you take that for what it is. If someone does an adaptation of it and you don't like it, that doesn't change the fact that the comic is still really good.
The fanboy can still read the comic over and over and over again. And anything externally from that, if they don't like it, it doesn't really hurt them. I mean, maybe it hurts their, maybe they're going to have sads about it, because somehow their life is so intrinsically attached to this particular project that anything that goes outside of that causes them a great deal of, you know, Cheeto anxiety.
Well, it's the same thing that happened with the Ghostbusters remake.
Right.
Yeah, you're going to ruin my childhood. Well, then your childhood blew.
Right.
I'm just saying that if a remake of a movie is going to destroy your childhood wasn't that good. Sorry.
So the idea is, okay, if it sucks, that's fine. It's not very good. History and television and criticism will do its due diligence. But if it doesn't suck, you know, maybe it could be good. We don't know. I think the concept of transferring The Watchmen to film has always been a fascinating idea to me. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Zack Snyder particularly succeeded, although I do not hate the movie like some folks do. I find aspects of the film to be very entertaining. And I think that Zack Snyder found some parts of the comic that he translated well to film.
Yeah, that opening sequence is one of the best things
filmed
in comic book history.
Did all of it succeed? No, but at the end of the day, it was an attempt.
Right.
And so for HBO to show an interest in, you know, serializing this, I don't know how what end plan they have for it, because, I mean, it is, there is a specific beginning and ending. Are they looking at 2 years? Can they do serialize this in like 2 10-episode seasons? I don't know, but why not?
Yeah, give it a shot. The potential for greatness much exceeds the potential for failure, in my mind.
And if it sucks, it sucks.
Yeah.
But nobody knows if that's going to happen. Nobody knows what's going to happen with it. We don't even know if it's actually going to happen.
Yeah. Well, a couple of years ago, then they announced that HBO is going to do a Westworld series.
Right.
And it's like, oh, well, you know, that sounds really stupid. You know, I didn't say this, but a lot of people said, if that sounds really dumb because, you know, it's just sort of 70s B movie. What can you do with a series? Right. Well, they proved what they could do with that series.
Yeah.
And it was truly outstanding.
And the first Westworld film, when I was a kid, I saw it on TV. I couldn't tell you what year it was, but I was a kid. So you're looking at probably somewhere in the mid 70s. That first movie scared the living bejesus out of me. Looking back on it now, it's a little cheesy, but at that time, I was like, that scared the bejesus out of me.
Yeah.
And now, you know, I would look back on it and maybe not so much, but the show took what I was afraid of as a kid and amplified it.
Yeah.
And I thought they did a really good job with it.
Yeah, and it took the philosophical premise of that, of what makes us human, and just really expanded it into something quite unique and pretty amazing. But we're not a Westworld podcast. But ultimately, I think the potential of a Watchmen series is exciting.
I do too, because I just think that this whole notion of the sacred cow, which Watchmen is a sacred cow, it deserves it in so many ways in terms of respect and revering that piece of work, but let people play with it a little bit. My goodness, how hard is it just to, how much does one's life depend on the sort of untouchable nature of Watchmen, that if someone wants to try to make a series of it, that your life is, that one's life is so destroyed?
Yeah. I mean, even Alan Moore says, I'm going to hate it. I'll never watch it. Do whatever you want. So, even
and who
author,
cares what Alan Moore says anyway?
I don't at all.
You know, he gave us this gift of Watchmen, and lo, we have prostrated our prostrated.
Prostrated? Don't be an ass, Brian.
That's even well done. I almost want to just stick with prostated. I almost want to just let that go. We have prostrated ourselves in front of this piece for so long that it has become almost a cipher.
Yeah. And it's very good. I
love Watchmen.
I do. I love it too, but
I still reread it and find interesting things that I never noticed before.
Exactly. But it's a thing, and it's a thing that can be adapted and expanded upon.
Yeah.
That's the whole point of this medium, is to be able to grow and expand and change.
Right. But if it sucks, it's going to suck, but maybe it'll be good. And at the point, if it's ever made, then we as a collective, the whole of fandom, and hopefully people outside of fandom, will approach it on the merits of it as a television show as opposed to a comic book.
Yeah.
And we will judge it from that rather than judge it as, oh, is this a, Rorschach was wearing this particular, thread count on his, on his coat, and, that's just not, screw those, screw that crap. But Rorschach better be a badass, and that's the only thing I will say. If Rorschach's not a badass.
That is one thing Snyder got right, was Rorschach was scary as shit in that movie.
So what? We're both pro. Wait, we didn't have a disagreement here.
No, we didn't. We don't have to disagree.
All right,
it's okay. It's okay.
So we're both pro Watchmen.
We're pro Watchmen as a concept, reserving the right to say if it sucks, I can say bad things about it.
Right.
So the next thing I want to talk about is probably something we're going to just spend the next 5 minutes saying I'm confused. So Dark Knight's Metal. This is the Batman-centric crossover, which will see the darker version of the Caped Crusader, and it will evidently continue this incarnation's obsession with death and mortality.
And apparently oomph metal.
Well, okay, so this past week, the...
This is why I'm making this, completely random sound.
I know. you're making it to the oomph degree.
Oh,
so all right. So this past week, the prelude issue to the series was released, called Dark Days: The Forge, which I did read in preparation for this episode because I'm a professional.
I'm also I am a novice.
Yeah, no, I'm also a very good liar. but even so, after I've read it. And there is a lot of metal. I still have questions. So I ask you, our resident DC expert, the hell is going on with this crossover?
Well, I need to put on my professor's cap to fully explain this to you in a way that you won't feel that I'm being pretentious or in any way denigrating all of the poor folks out there who don't understand the complexities of the DC universe and how this fits into it. So I will try to get my professorial tone in check, where I tell you and explain this to you in as succinct a way as possible.
Too late.
I have absolutely no stinking idea.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't even get my funny book store to clarify to me what comics I need to put in my pull list and what comics I don't, because you know who doesn't know? The comic book stores don't know. Nobody, yeah. Because there's 20 different titles.
Yes,
some of them are part of a series, some of them are one shots, some of them may tie in, but nobody knows.
It's got to be a massive crossover. And yeah, I just, are they going to try to incorporate the dark multiverse into this new rebirth?
Well, that is one of the things I've heard, is that it's a dark multi, it's part of the dark multiverse, and it's alternate sort of, it's alternate characters, right? It's like Batman and Dark Batman, Superman and Dark Superman. You know, because we haven't seen that stuff already in a million different variations.
Yeah, well, they're still doing already. Injustice, right? So,
right. You know, we already have multiple dimensions and multiple worlds with the avatars of the heroes that we have grown up with. I mean, this could be great. You know, part of me is like, in Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo, we trust, right? Maybe, yes, I don't know. Not everybody loves Snyder and Capullo's run on Batman. Some people adore it. I enjoyed it. I don't think it's the greatest run I've ever seen, but I don't think it's the worst run I've ever seen, and I think they introduced some very interesting concepts.
No, I thought it was pretty good myself. Yeah. I'm not really all that enthralled with Scott Snyder's new All-Star Batman. It's okay.
Yeah, and it's ending soon anyway. I mean, I think, well, now it's in a new format. We'll see how that works out. But I wish, as a rabid DC fan that I am, I could tell you that I have any sense of what's about to happen. I have theories and I have conspiracy theories, but if I'm putting this to tape, then I will be mocked endlessly in 2 months when all of my theories fall through the floor.
Oh, that's the beauty of this medium, man.
I know.
Recorded for posterity.
I have a
posterity.
I have strong opinions on things that have been. I have weak opinions on things that will be.
Well, you haven't read The Forge yet, but they introduce certain characters that aren't in Rebirth yet, like Hawkman.
Right. And Hawkman is, by all accounts, I think the assumption is that Hawkman is going to be a major player in this.
It looks like it. Yes. And they're going back to the original Hawkman. So, like,
because they've had so much success in reviving Aquaman that let's go and try to revolve Hawkman.
I don't think that's a bad idea. I mean, it seems to me that Rebirth is attempting to bring back all the good stuff from the past while just dismissing all the unwanted elements.
Right.
I mean, because there's a few good things in New 52 wasn't exactly highly regarded.
Well, there were some good things in New 52. I think the Jonah Hex series was actually great.
Yeah. So I said, not all of it was bad.
Dial H for Hero happened in New 52.
Yeah. So what it seems to me is that they're trying to take all that good stuff and pull it into Rebirth, you know, incorporate that into Rebirth, jettisoning all the other stuff that they don't want.
Right.
And then grabbing everything from pre and post crisis that they like as well and making that canon.
Well, that's what I'm curious about is this going to be a crisis level event? Again, information is sketchy, but if this is a reset so recently after like a reset.
Well, you've already seen in Action Comics where the new Superman, who is the old Superman.
there's the Superman and the Lois Lane, and then there's the other Superman and the Lois Lane, and there's the son who may not be the son, and there's...
Right, but the new Superman... The third Superman.
I'm sorry, I'm going off.
So the new Superman, who's the old Superman, has this moment where he remembers all the stuff from post-crisis.
Right.
Plus he also remembers things from New 52, at least the stuff that you want to remember.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have this new character who is a combination of everything that went before. So it's DC has really eaten that cake, having the cake and eating it too is what I'm trying to get at.
I think it's way more complicated with DC because of the history that DC has that Marvel just does not have in the same kind of realm. I mean, in terms of the sheer mass of characters, the sheer mass of history, etc. Is Scott Snyder's, I'm going to call it Scott Snyder's Batman project, because nobody can even like come up with like exactly what it's supposed to be called. So Scott Snyder's Batman event or project for the summer fall, which leads into Doomsday, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Which is also going to be another reset crossover.
Yeah. I mean, DC has brought about so much goodwill with what they have been doing. And I think that what I'm fearing with this metal thing is that some of that goodwill might be squandered by a incredibly confusing and convoluted storyline that's going to throw a whole bunch of stuff at the wall.
Are they having conversations with Marvel? That's what I want to know.
Are they going to go the Marvel way and just like?
Because I'm losing it with Marvel right now. Yeah. Just stop endless, crossing crap over.
Yeah, the endless everything changes forever event, and it just I don't know. Like, you know, I don't know what metal is. I wish I knew what metal was. If they explained it better, maybe we could have a better sort of take on it and be like, oh, I'm excited for this because this is what this is going to accomplish. But they haven't explained that. Like, they can't even get what issues we're supposed to buy, like, settled. And that sounds to me like your typical Marvel event right now where you can't figure out.
It also sounds to me, because Rebirth has some pretty damn good creators going on right now who have their own thing going.
Yes.
And it sounds to me like now there's a company-wide mandate, you have to do this. I don't think everyone's on board.
Well, it's weird because if it's coming from Snyder, then it means it's coming from Geoff Johns.
Yeah.
Who generally I would feel has a better sense of how to make good comics than what I would think of if it was an event coming from Dan Didio, who I don't hate. I think the guy loves what he does. But at the same time, it's like you have Geoff Johns events and you have Dan Didio events. And Geoff Johns events succeed and Dan Didio events do not. It is like, you know, Snyder and Geoff Johns are tight. So you actually are seeing now like some Snyder events versus Didio events, because I think they are in slight conflict. And if it's a Scott Snyder event, it's got to be coming through Geoff Johns and not Dan Didio.
You would think, but
I'm guessing on all of this.
Yeah. Well, that's my thing. I actually read that issue and said, I still don't get it. I mean, it's interesting. The artwork's beautiful and it's well, you know, structured. I just don't know what the story is.
Nobody does. I feel like I'm repeating myself. I feel like our poor listeners have like had to hear me repeat the same thing over and over and over again. But like, just tell us what this is about. And I don't even mean like from a spoiler point of view. They don't have to tell us how it ends. But for the love of Pete, tell us what they're doing and what this is supposed to be, because you know, I will pick up these issues because, well, that's what I do. But
that's not a good sign when there's not even, you don't even get a pitch for it.
Yeah. And some of the images, I don't know, you were saying it looks pretty but some of the images just look kind of like generic DC circa 1995. And
well, a lot of that is
go back to 1995, and I think one of these issues are being advertised with foil embossed covers. Oh my god!
Well, that's what I was saying earlier. How I think that they're trying to pull in the plot elements and the storylines that they want.
Right.
This new Rebirth, and a lot of this has to do with going back to the 80s and 90s and grabbing all the little bits that they like and pulling them in.
Which is fine if, you give us a good Metal Men comic. If you give us a good Legion of Superheroes comic. Hmm. If you give us, you know, these comics that, if you give us comics that are from that time period that are interesting and are exciting, then fine. Go back to that well, bring it out. And give us some good writers, give us some good artists, give us some good stories that don't have editors hovering over everything and that are not tied in continuously with events. I mean, this is the knock on Marvel.
Right.
And it's a legitimate knock on Marvel. So for the love of God, DC, don't do the same thing.
I agree. And this is coming from the perspective of a Marvel fan. Don't be like Marvel. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Rebirth has been so good so far, and I would love to see that continue. And it looks like they're just, I don't know, they're throwing a monkey wrench into the works here. And, you know, just stop crossing over. Just let some stories be told first.
And again, the same with The Watchmen, which we discussed earlier. This could be great.
Yeah.
It could be great. I don't want to be that guy that is automatically the skeptic when anything is announced. You know, I mean, because we also have, like, Mr. Miracle coming. Yay. How exciting is that?
He already pops up, by the way.
I'm not surprised. Like, from what I've heard, there are some B, C, D list characters that show up in this issue, and I bet some of them I will be very excited about, as long as they're treated well.
You know, it's an interesting thing. I wish I knew more about it. It gives me pause.
And I apologize as the DC expert that I can't tell you more about it because I wish I knew more about it.
Yeah. It just gets my back up that, you know, I've been enjoying these stories for a while now, and I'm looking forward to seeing them continue. And I just don't want to see them muck it up, you know, with a silly crossover that it, you know, what Marvel does is they do these crossovers and then it takes several months or years to dig themselves out of this hole that they built. You know, I've mentioned this a couple of times on the show, how their treatment of Captain Marvel in Civil War II is going to take years to untangle that, to get back to. It was an excellent character telling excellent stories, and
they turned her into a fascist.
Yeah. And it's going to end.
And now she has a movie coming out.
Well, and the movie is probably going to do the reset for them, which is what's happened. I mean, that's what happened with Iron Man. It's what happened with Captain America. And speaking of Captain America, we should probably move on
to our topic of the day.
Yes. But first, let's take a quick break.
But first, I was just going to say, let's take a quick break.
Well, let's do it then. Hey there. Do you like Man Thing? You know I do. In fact, there is nothing I like more than getting my hands on a giant-sized Man Thing. It just makes me feel so good. Wait, you know I'm talking about the comic book character, right? Of course you do. How could you be thinking anything else? Man Thing was created in the early 1970s to capitalize on the growing monster craze, but under writer Steve Gerber it became something quite different. Experimental, surreal, and very, very weird. It was something I loved as a kid. But does it still hold up today, 4 decades after its initial publication? So join me, Paul Matthew Carr, as I attempt to make sense of this cult classic and analyze each issue, putting it in the context of the time it was written and comparing it to the standards of today. And maybe you too can come to love the world's second most famous swamp-based comic book character as much as I do. The Nexus of All Realities, a Man-Thing podcast, a twice-monthly dive into the bizarre. Oh, and I'll probably make some penis jokes. And we're back. So today we're going to be discussing Captain America by Steve Englehart, Volume 1, Secret Empire. This collects Captain America and the Falcon, number 169 to 176 from 1974.
And yet still very timely.
Yes. It's written by Steve Englehart and with art by Sal Buscema. This arc introduces us to the Secret Empire, a nefarious group that wants to overthrow America with the use of advertising and the wearing of hoods. As is typical of comics of this time, it's written in an episodic, almost soap opera style. And as such, there's no real start and end points. It's meant to be a continuous story that just runs and runs and runs. These issues do a pretty good job of telling a contained story arc, but past plot points do crop up, as well as seeds for future stories that don't pay off yet. So I will do my best to be as concise as possible in my synopsis.
And I will do my best to be not as concise as possible.
There you go. Is there anything you want to add before I begin?
Well, not really, other than I think your choice is very prescient, which I think was your intent. But I would like to just state off the bat that Sal Buscema's art, my goodness, if we could have put him in the contemporary non-four color format.
Oh, yeah.
It would have been phenomenal. So I'll just lay that out there and then continue on with the themes, Paul. Sorry.
Okay, so issue 169. We begin with a gang of thugs attacking Falcon, who holds his own but is slightly outmatched because of the fight being 5-on-1. Cap then shows up to help his friend, and the thugs scatter. Falcon feels as if he's just standing in Cap's shadow and wants to be something more than just a costumed athlete. So Cap hooks him up with Black Panther at his request, and they try to come up with a plan. Meanwhile, Cap sees an ad from the Committee to Regain America's Principles, or...
Crap!
So Englehart...
I love 70s comics.
Yeah, so Englehart not being subtle. This ad claims that Captain America is simply a drugged-up vigilante with no respect for authority. Understandably, Cap is miffed. Cap then goes to the offices of Crap to confront Quentin Haldeman, Haldeman agrees to stop the ads if he shows up for a charity event later in the day. When he leaves, Cap then runs in with the Tumbler, one of a series of gymnastic-based villains that Cap has had to deal with during his career. Tumbler does escape, but turns up later at that same charity event, and in an ill-advised move, Cap attacks Tumbler in front of everyone, who then falls down dead, and Cap gets the blame. But it's really just a setup from a mysterious villain hiding in the ceiling. Also, there's a romantic subplot between Sharon and Peggy Carter that's just creepy, and we won't mention it.
Oh, come on. That's one of the best parts.
Oh, come on. At least in the movies, they make it, you know, Sharon's her niece, not sisters. Good God.
Sisters who shouldn't be sisters.
I know.
Yeah. 70s comics.
Oh, my God.
Please go on, Paul, with your synopsis.
Okay. Issue 170. J'accuse. It should be noted that for the next two issues, Mike Friedrich becomes the writer. The plot and storyline is still by Englehart, but at this time, Englehart was off writing a couple other titles, so he had a fill-in writer for him. A little bit of trivia.
Marvel style.
So Cap is accused of the murder of Tumbler, and as all innocent men do, he runs away, beating down the police as he does so. He's then confronted by Moonstone, a new superhero on the block that gets his power from a moonstone.
I'm sorry.
He got his naming convention.
Please keep this. Yes.
He got his naming convention from Obvious R Us. So Moonstone takes Cap down, and Haldeman immediately crowns him the new symbol of America, which the crowd agrees with because the American people are nothing if not fickle. Cap is arrested, thrown in jail, and this allows Moonstone to remember his backstory for a bit. Meanwhile, in Wakanda, Black Panther and Falcon plan some fancy new wings, while Falcon's girlfriend Leela and Panther's handmaiden Tanzika argue, talk jive, and fail to pass the Bechdel test.
And they also go shopping.
Yeah. Later in town, Leela is kidnapped by a Harlem mobster who happens to be in Africa because convenience. But this does give Falcon a chance to spread his wings, literally.
Oh!
The issue ends with Cap being broken out of jail by a group of supporters, leaving Cap to ruminate on how the country is polarized into two camps. While not wanting to break the law, he does need to escape. What should he do?
Dun, dun, dun!
Dun, dun, dun! Issue 171. Cap is broken out of prison by the sanitation unit. Okay, I did write what my notes here do say. Side note, Cap's villains are stupid. And Cap correctly deduces that they are in league with Haldeman and Moonstone because he got his shield back. Trust me, it makes sense if you don't think about it too much. He beats them down. Meanwhile, in Wakanda, Panther and Falcon attempt to track down Leela's kidnappers, where it turns out that Stoneface, the Harlem mobster, is really just looking for a back-home woman for his own and offers her gems.
Love is all you need, Paul. Yes.
She implies that his personal resources aren't worth much, if you know what I'm saying. When Panther and Falcon burst in a moment of comedy, Falcon is unable to control his new wings and ends up knocking himself and Panther out. Stoneface then tries to throw them off a cliff, but Falcon regains control of his wings and saves Panther so they can beat Stoneface and his goons. With his lady safe, Falcon and Leela head back to New York, where Falcon is tasked by Iron Man to find Cap, who is still on the run. He does find him.
Cap on the run.
Yes. He does find him, and after some catching up and plot recap, they are attacked by Moonstone, who knocks them out.
Fight scene.
Yes, in fact. Okay, so this next bit, I'm going to cover 172, 173, and 174, because they're all pretty fight-heavy, so I sort of combined all those.
Yeah, one of the great things about the 70s comics is, like, it is all about the action.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of these issues are just fight scenes.
Well, no, they talk and think a lot during it. Here, let me have this fight scene, but I'll tell you my backstory as I do.
Can I just say that I miss the thought balloons?
I do too.
Yeah. So, but these issues are heavy on the thought balloons whilst the fight scenes are going.
Yes.
Yes. So carry on, Paul.
Okay, so this next bit is going to be a synopsis of three issues in one. Three issues in one. Moonstone takes Cap and Falcon to Central Park on Haldeman's orders, where he meets up with the sanitation squad, who have changed their name for some reason, and who prepare to call the media in order to discredit them some more. Again, don't think too hard on this. It makes complete sense. Trust me.
Just as a clarification, my reading was that it was the cat's name was Harderman, not Haldeman.
Is that right? I've been calling him Haldeman this whole time. Is it Halder?
All right, this is the part we cut out.
Oh, yeah. Yes, it is Harderman. You are correct, sir. I have been pronouncing
it. Because the Beavis and Butthead in me has been chuckling over not just crap, but Harderman.
You are correct.
So chop this stuff out. I just wanted to clarify because I thought maybe I had read it wrong because I'm a 12-year-old boy.
It is harder, man. Holy crap, I've been reading it wrong. But that's all right. I'll put in a little thing here that says, note, Paul doesn't know what he's talking about.
Quint, and it's Quint Harderman.
Quentin Harderman. Okay.
The jokes just write themselves. But anyway, back to what you were doing. Sorry.
No problem. Captain Falcon regain consciousness and put a beat down on their captors and escape. Cap then remembers that Moonstone mentioned a moon rock and country music, so obviously the only place those things can be are in Nashville, and they hitchhike to Nashville, because why not?
And to clarify, like at some point, like all the country music references, at some point they were talking about, he said something about like something being as clear as Hank Williams' guitar. Hank Williams' guitar was never clear. I just want to make sure that is...
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. It's as subtle as a crowbar.
Yeah.
To get this thing in there. In Nashville, Cap literally bumps into Banshee, who thinks they are there to arrest him, so he assaults them with an ultrasonic scream and a bad accent.
Banshee being a former X-Men character.
Yes, an X-Men villain, I believe.
Initially, yes.
Yes. A long battle ensues, and when it seems over for our heroes, they're rescued by Cyclops, Professor X, and Marvel Girl. Professor X then tells Cap they should team up because the same group that is attempting to discredit him is also after them. Then, in an attempt to get everyone in the Marvel Universe into this story, they're confronted by Nick Fury and the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Fighting commences. They eventually escape to an abandoned mine where Professor X is able to give some extended backstory so as to get us up to date on the X-Men and to let us know that the mutants are disappearing due to the machinations of the Secret Empire.
And it should be noted that Professor X, as always, is a chatty mother.
Oh, yes. He is. He is
exposition. Professor X tends to go on a bit.
He's exposition central. That is true. He's exposition. Hey, didn't plan that. That's good.
Well done.
All right. The Secret Empire is a devious group that uses such diabolical weapons as advertising, propaganda, and utilizes their agents in Madison Avenue. Led, of course, by Quentin Quentin Harderman. So the group come up with an elaborate scheme in which Cyclops pretends to kidnap a suspected member of the Secret Empire while an undercover Cap and Falcon pretend to rescue her in order to gain her trust. This works for some reason. They have to commit a robbery in order to be accepted into the Secret Empire's ranks, which again works, go figure, and they are admitted into the secret lair of the Secret Empire. Once there, they find out the plan of the Secret Empire. They plan to conquer America by discrediting its heroes, perverting facts, and demoralizing the public's faith in government, while at the same time installing a criminal puppet as the symbol of the country. Of course, this is fiction, and nothing like that could ever, ever happen in this country.
Oh, no.
My note here is, pause for a sarcastic comedy beat. They then attempt to murder Cap and Falcon, who escape at the last minute, but who are then attacked by a giant murder robot because because of course they are. They defeat the murder bot and hook up again with the X-Men and find the missing mutants strapped to a machine of some kind. While attempting to rescue them, they are attacked by the goons of the Secret Empire, who knock them unconscious.
It should be also noted that the blob could not be hooked up to the same machine.
I know. He had to have his own separate little table.
Carry on.
Yes. Issue 175. After being taken down, Cap and Falcon are taken away by two members of the Secret Empire. But lo and behold, it's really Gabe Jones and Peggy Carter, S.H.I.E.L.D. agents in disguise. They rescue our heroes and provide some more backstory. Meanwhile, the Secret Empire's plan goes into full effect. They land on the White House lawn in a fake alien ship and have Moonstone battle them, only to reveal to the people that there is no hope and there is atomic bombs placed around the country and there is a gyro thing. And okay, let's face it, it's pretty convoluted, but comics, ladies and gentlemen, comics. So Cap fights to save America, and even though Moonstone is more powerful, Cap has spirit and is able to prevail. I'm not making that up. At this point, the head of the Secret Empire, Number One, tries to escape and runs into the Oval Office, where it is discovered that he is none other than the man with the highest office in the land. He kills himself rather than face justice. And Cap, disillusioned, leaves a broken man.
Sad.
Very sad. Issue 176, I won't go into great detail, but this issue is really the coda to the story. In it, Cap wrestles with his conflicted feelings on the meaning of the title of Captain America. He is disillusioned by the real-world politics, dismayed about how quickly the public turned against him, and upset by the fact that his friends didn't immediately stand by him. After much soul-searching and the protests of Falcon and the members of the Avengers, Cap decides to step down and quit the mantle of Captain America and be Captain America no more. This decision will last forever. Spoiler, it's not forever. But it does last for quite a bit in comics time. So.
Right. Well, it's the all-new, all-different Marvel, mm-hmm. right? All-new, all-different, everything changes forever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this, you know, just to go on, in future stories from here on out, for quite a while, Steve Rogers becomes Nomad, who is Captain America with no country. Mm-hmm. So, as a political statement there. So that was it. That was the original Secret Empire arc. Brian, what did you think?
Well, it's so iconic. I mean, yes. The storyline is so iconic. And this was the first time Marvel has done this particular storyline. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong, which I'm sure someone will. But it is a storyline that has been recycled ad nauseum by Marvel for the next 30 years.
You mean where Cap steps down from the...
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, Cap is constantly stepping down. We have the abortion that is the Secret Empire story going on right now. Did I just give a personal opinion? I did.
Hard to tell what your feelings are on that.
But this is comics. I mean, and this particular arc is exactly what made comics so stinking great. Like, the 60s stuff is interesting, but it wasn't until you got into the 70s that, like, you got this type of storyline, right? That just was, we can nitpick, like, some of the bad dialogue. Well, there's terrible dialogue in this, and, you know, some of the cheesy imagery or whatever. I mean, there's a scene where Angel, the X-Men Angel, is relaxing and reading a book. he's wearing his uniform with his wings out, sitting in a chair, relaxing, reading a book.
Hey, that's just Angel chilling, man.
It's just Angel chilling. And some of that is really silly, and we look at it now in a modern context, particularly to reference something we spoke earlier about, post-Watchmen, where some of this stuff is like, you know, you're just like, it's goofy and silly. But at the same time, it's kind of brilliant.
Yeah.
And it's not just brilliant, it's fun. Like, this whole arc, which I haven't read in I don't even know how long. So thank you, Paul, for recommending this.
Oh, yeah.
But it's so of its time, but it is also timeless. In terms of, we could take all the silly stuff, the angel reading the book or whatever, but we look at this arc, and basically this arc, and I'm sure this is where you're going to go, Paul, and I think you could say this way better than I can, so I'll just wrap it up. But this is post-Watergate, and this is comics trying to come to grips with the world around it and with what the, for lack of these are American-made comics, so let's just say the American dream and sort of the concept of what is America and what are the ideals. And I think that this comic really, and Steve Englehart was a bit of a lefty.
Oh, yeah.
I think brilliantly sort of, in its own way, tries to like take a pulse of a nation that comics really had not done in any serious way before this.
Oh yeah. And this is that year 74. So things are changing at this time where, you know, the comics code was still in effect. It was lessened to a certain extent.
Right.
But it was still in effect. So an outright direct criticism of the president was not going to happen. That's why in the reveal at the end, you don't actually see who the person is.
And to be fair, it never specifically said it was the president. It said it was a person of high political stance.
Right. But it's heavily implied that it's Nixon.
Yes.
So that in itself was a serious political statement. But you know, this wasn't even post-Watergate. This was at the height of the Watergate scandal. It was still going on at the time. And Englehart was trying to infuse these rather innocuous, simple stories with some contemporary politics. And
right.
Sure, it's heavy-handed, for no doubt.
Oh, it's very heavy-handed, but all comics at that time, because all comics at that time were very exposition-heavy.
Yes. But Captain America is, you know, the one character in the Marvel Universe that most embodies America. He wears a flag on his chest. So he embodies America, or rather, he embodies the myth of America. And by making him conflicted with that mythology, you know, not everything is black and white. There are questions about whether or not the government is doing the right thing, about whether or not the country was living up to the ideals of that mythology. And what Englehart was doing, I think, was pretty admirable and innovative.
Well, and you saw this in not just in Captain America's quest, but you saw this in the Falcon's quest. You saw this in Black Panther making some references. You saw this in the X-Men, who were also part of this intent to denigrate a group of people, and they are part of like this the crap organization. was also trying to take down the X-Men as well. And of course, the X-Men being avatars for that which is different.
Yeah, for the minorities and the and the excluded. You know, I made
the LGBTQ, which didn't exist at the time, but neither here nor there.
Well, you know, I made the joke in the synopsis that it was their attempt to get everyone in the Marvel Universe into this story, which is funny, but at the same time, look at what they did. They put the X-Men in, like you said. You know, they're the embodiment of, you know, everyone who's on the outside.
Right.
But immediately S.H.I.E.L.D., who is, you know, working for the establishment, just immediately goes after Cap. They don't question their orders.
Although with even they had that scene where Nick Fury was sort of like questioning what they were doing.
Yeah, but he still did it. And that's, you know,
quote unquote following orders.
Right. And then you also have ultra-rich billionaire Tony Stark, who doesn't actually help. He can't get his hands dirty, but so he sends Falcon out to go and do it for him.
Right.
You know, so Englehart, yes, he's trying to incorporate...
He sends the black man out.
Yeah, well, Englehart's trying to incorporate everyone into the shared universe, of course, but they're all in very specific roles, and they're all making very specific points.
And some of those, to be fair, are stereotypes.
Well, yeah.
In terms of how each person reacts.
This is 1974.
This is 1974.
Yes. Baby steps, Brian.
Yeah.
You know, I said before in our previous Godland episode how the mimicking the writing style of this era in a modern setting didn't work for me. Mm-hmm. But I'm much more forgiving of it in this time period. Because this was the style, and this was, you know, the ethics of the time.
And there was an allowance. Let's give Marvel credit. There was an allowance at that time for these type of social, because this was a social statement story, and yes, Marvel allowed that. Whereas nowadays, with the internet and whatnot, you run into trouble every time you do this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was some. I don't know. Creative anarchy going on in the early 70s here.
Yes, very much.
the whole group of writers were very young, very much part of the counterculture. Many smoking the funny weed. So, you know, these things were being incorporated into the storylines. And I think taking something like Captain America, which is very much, I mean, he's very much a symbol of our country, obviously. Right. And to make him conflicted, to add these contemporary political ideas into his story, that was very brave of Englehart to do.
Well, and to make him conflicted about it, as opposed to just being a yes man.
Yes, exactly. He puts a lot of thought into this. The character of Steve Rogers, he thinks a lot about, you know, what does it mean to do what I'm doing and to be what I am.
And particularly in the last issue, where the first page is that iconic, completely. I mean, that's the thing is, like, you know, the last issue is that iconic first page where it's like Captain America must die. And that's Captain America saying Captain America must die. And that has been imitated over and over and over again. But I mean, that first page, it's iconic for a reason. And, you know, anybody listening to this who has ever read comics knows exactly what this page is. And if you don't, look up the first page, kids, because
it's very much on the same level as, you know, when Spider-Man throws his uniform in the trash can.
Yes.
That Ditko. You know,
I mean, this is that scene says way more than the image can convey, but the image conveys way more than what one could ever say in words.
Yes.
And it's a great moment in comics history.
Yes, indeed. Well, let's talk about some of the subplots here, and the first and major being that this is where Falcon gets his wings. I think it's really interesting that they chose to let Black Panther be the one to build the wings for him.
Well, 1974, of course they did.
No, I think that was a conscious choice on the creator's part to say, I'm not going to have the white guy, Iron Man, build these wings.
Right, because he could have.
Yeah, and in the past, he probably would have.
Except that Wilson was probably slightly beneath Tony Stark's notice.
Well, yes, but I don't think they were really pushing that particular agenda. But what do you think of that whole storyline of going to Wakanda and having the having the Harlem girlfriend just not liking that this boring old Africa?
Oh, besides the God bless you, Steve Englehart, but besides the sort of like sexist, racist like nature of that entire conversation,
yes.
I mean, we got Jive Ass in there, I think. We got it's painful to read now, but at the same time.
Yes, it's very much a white man writing.
It's a white man
black
writing.
Jive. Yes.
Black Jive in 1970, whatever.
1974.
And while I can excuse it in terms of like his attempt, at the same time, those were some of the more awkward and difficult portions to read, like here in 2017.
Yes, I agree.
It's a little brutal, and both Marvel and DC have some guilt in terms of that sort of language at the time. And again, I can see that they were attempting to be hip and with the times, but yowza. I mean, some of that was rough.
Yes, it is.
I mean, that whole like segment was just it's tough to read.
It is tough to read. I do like how in 1974 everyone wore form-fitting jumpsuits as a matter of course.
Well, I know in 1974 as a 2-year-old I was wearing a form-fitting jumpsuit myself. And I looked fantastic.
Oh, I'm sure.
Actually, I still pull it out now and again, but that's nobody's business but my own.
I think there's there's so many things in this.
I feel like I threw you a little bit there.
you did.
Was it the form-fitting jumpsuit?
I just pictured you in a onesie. Not really what I was intending on doing today.
But I think our audience will appreciate that.
You know, to be fair, now that I'm looking back at this, this dialogue was not written by Steve Englehart. It was actually by Frederick.
Yeah, there's some weird...
Because this was
doing the part where Englehart was not writing. He was plotting, but not writing.
Right. So, what was it, 70 and 71, those two issues both, which deal primarily with the Black Panther side story, were all written by Mike Frederick, or Frederich. Let's go with Frederick.
Or, if we're getting really crazy, Friedrich.
Friedrich. Yeah, you're probably right. It's probably Friedrich. And I wonder if this is an editing problem or if it's just not connected because, you know, Cap is broken out by the sanitation unit.
Who are working for crap.
Yes, sanitation unit working for crap. Yes. This is not...
I mean, the fact that this got through editorial, and you know who editorial was? It's Roy Thomas.
It's Roy Thomas.
The legend, Roy Thomas. You know he let this go through.
Oh, absolutely.
Because he's one of the smartest, best editors ever in the history of comics, and he let that go through.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I do another podcast on Man-Thing with Steve Gerber, and Roy Thomas is the editor on all those Man-Thing things, and he just lets him get away with anything he wants. So, sure, go ahead. Why not?
The two best editors maybe in the history of all comics are Roy Thomas and Archie Goodwin.
Mm-hmm.
You could probably cut that out because it doesn't have anything to do with anything.
Yes. Well, when the point I was, and then Sanitation Unit gets changed to Sanitation Squad later. It's a subtle thing to pick up on. I usually catch that sort of thing.
Right.
And it's probably just, I don't know, just something that got missed because there was two writers writing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. The fact that it's the Sanitation Unit or the Sanitation Squad working for crap, that's just... Wow, that's just great. I do want to do...
I'm loving how you're going to edit this.
I know. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm trying to think of it right now. But I have to... And no, I should say I'm a massive Captain America fan. That's one of my favorite characters of all time. That being said, when he's written well, it's amazing. When he's written poorly, it's just, you know... jingoistic garbage.
Well, I think that's the nature of the character, and I think the time and where we are at any given era. I think that Captain America is a character that is used over and over and over again, and I think he suggests being used. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. But he works best when he has, in much the same way that Superman works best, where he wants to save everyone. Yeah, where he wants to save everyone but can't. So how does he make those choices? And the added dimension of Captain America is that he's also a soldier. So does he follow orders even if those orders mean that he'll be doing something immoral?
Well, and I think that's the meat of this whole arc, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. He views something as being done incorrectly or he views something that is not in keeping with the standard that he has been brought up with. And so his initial reaction is to react against. But his government, that which he answers to as a soldier, is telling him to go the other direction. I mean, isn't that the crux of this whole arc?
Yes, and that's why I think this arc is so brilliant and relevant today. Because... you know, because the nature of Captain America is a soldier and following orders and working for the government, he's not just a costume vigilante. He actually does have ties to the government. And to make the government the ultimate villain is an absolute brilliant thing to do. And it's very, very much contemporary of the time because people did lose faith. Before Watergate, you might have had some disagreements with your political party or your president, but everyone still pretty much said, yeah, you know what? I disagree with them, but they're still working for the betterment, you know, of everyone in the country. After Watergate, that was out the window. And we have the political environment that we have today because of this.
I feel like this comic is a distillation of the disillusionment. I feel like this comic does several things. Like it exposes the disillusionment by the populace in terms of like the government and what we believe. It's reacting to Watergate. It's reacting to a lot of different things with the government.
And fake news.
And fake news. Because, yes, this was fake news 33 years ago or however many, 43 years ago. Discrediting Captain America was right, the fake news that was going on.
Yes. So it's 1974. Steve Englehart was the first person to say, fake news is crap. If you want to look at it, this is when it all began. Where we are today started in this time period.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the divisions that we feel were all started, you can trace it back to this era of our government.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of sad that after 43 years, we're still doing the same things, even worse now.
But to comics, it's just, you know, I mean, the frustrating part about this is, like, you know, 43 years ago, and this is what's great about comics, and this is why we're here, this is what we want, this is like the important thing to us. We had Steve Englehart using an iconic American cipher, something that is still like iconic to this day. I mean, Captain America is still iconic to this day. We still see that shield, whatever. And this is what is so great about this arc, that an individual who has been tasked with representing an ideal that he finds to be false, and it doesn't have a left or right political bent to it. It is an ideal that he finds to be false, and he feels that he has been betrayed. And what that leads to is that last issue in this arc, which is not a very good issue in general, because most of it is just like rehashing origin stories. Iron Man, Thor, Vision, whoever else are coming to like preach to him about why he should be this thing. But at the end of the arc, he's like, this ideal that I believe in, because of all of the things that have happened through this 8-issue arc, he says, enough. I can't stand up to this. And I think that is a powerful moment, in that it's not a left or right political decision. It is an individual who has decided that they have been used for a standard that they can no longer stand for. And at the end of this arc, despite all of the people coming at him saying, you need to still continue to be Captain America, he lays down his shield and he says, no more.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, that rehashing.
Who could do that in 1974?
I guess that's what I said. This was a very brave thing to do. And you talked about the rehashing of all the origin stories and the previous things that he'd done. Englehart does that for a specific reason, because he knows that that's where the criticism is going to come from this.
Right.
It's well, what about this? What about this? And what about this? And what about his history? What about World War II? So he addresses all of that in this issue, but it does seem a bit tedious and heavy-handed.
It's very didactic. I mean, all of Marvel in the 70s, and all of DC, frankly, although DC didn't go quite as far as Marvel did in the 70s, it's all didactic.
Yes.
It's all preachy.
Oh, yes, and it's very obvious. I mean, we're not allowed to just see what's going on. They have to tell you, and now I'm throwing my shield.
Right.
You know, so there's, you know, but that's a style of writing of that time. And like I said, I'm much more forgiving of that sort of thing, because that's how it was done in this era.
Right.
That's how comics were written. You know, they evolved quite a bit after that. But guess what I was getting at was that, you know, Englehart was very smart in writing this.
Yes.
You know, by addressing all of the, like, I know what everyone's going to say, and I know how people are going to react, and I'm going to address all that in this issue, and I'm going to say this is why he chooses to reject that. So it's just very impressive to me.
And he took it in a direction that in any other medium, I don't believe any other medium, he would have gotten away with that. And I think this draws it back to comics. You can do it in comics what you can't do in other mediums, partly because at that time nobody took it seriously, right? I mean, it was just a thing that, like,
oh, these were just the kiddie books that, you know,
exactly.
These were just for kids.
Yeah.
You know,
it's that not attitude just,
has changed
it's just,
quite a bit.
And it's just not this arc. It's like the X-Men arc, which was, you know, basically advocating for LGBTQ rights. Of course, those phrases didn't exist at the time.
Yeah, and if you look at, it seems weird to say, but Magneto and Professor X were basically Malcolm X and Martin Luther King.
And Martin Luther King, right.
Yeah.
I mean, what's amazing about this arc, besides the fact, I mean, I should clarify that this arc, these 8 issues, are a hoot to read. And I think they're, like, a lot of fun to read. And I think people should read it just for strictly entertainment value, because this is pre-deconstructionism, where it is like so much happens in every issue and so much fun and so much, you know, half of these issues are like almost all action. You know what I mean? And it's like, it's all action. And this is why we read comics.
And this was a time of snarky editorial asides as well.
Right.
Every you got all these great things every once in a while, like, you'll remember that from issue 112, True Believers. Right. You know, I actually just love that sort of thing.
And again, back to Roy Thomas, who was doing all those.
Yes. There was one, and I don't have it in front of me, which issue this started out with. But it, you know, in one of the, you know, the opening splash page, it recaps what just happened, and then it says, in a big, you know, action bubble, in words of one syllable, gulp.
yes. No, I know that. I almost made a note about that that issue. Yes, but gulp, and maybe that is where all this falls. Like one big page of gulp.
It is. I adore these old stories and these comics from the 70s. I go back to them quite often just because they're so much fun and because the artwork is so just dynamic and just fun. That's the word that I keep coming back to. These are fun. And the message is heavy-handed and the dialogue is stilted from time to time. But you know what? All that can be forgiven because they're just a joy to read.
Because with all of that, what you have is like a giant murder monster or murder robot, right?
I know. And where did that come from?
Yeah. You know, and you have like these like insane action sequences or whatever. And this is what we want. You know, it's like comics don't have to have a social conscience, but I think there are many times in which they reflect the social conscience at the time. And, you know, this is a medium. I'm so glad you recommended this, Paul, because I think this run really shows sort of the genius of comics as both a visual medium and a medium for escape, but also a medium if you didn't want to escape. If you wanted to read a little bit more into it, you could, but you didn't have to.
Right. You didn't, you know, you didn't have to see. They do outright mention Watergate a handful of times throughout the run, but If you didn't want to see a political message in this, you don't have to.
Right.
I mean, we see it because that's, you know, we're grown-ups and we see that sort of thing. And we're specifically looking for it. But, I read this as a kid.
Yes, as did I.
Yeah. And it was just a fun adventure story.
Exactly.
So it just means, you know, these comics exist. They are totally of their time, but they exist outside of their time as well.
Very much so. And I think this is a thing that needs to be preserved and continually talked about. And we even talked about like the great art or the goofy like action sequences, crazy aliens. And we have representation of like things that you could never see in real life. And at the same time, sometimes they tell us something about ourselves.
I think that what you just said was a perfect way to end.
But Paul, you have a recommendation for our next podcast.
I do. For the next time, I'm going to recommend the celebrated run of Wonder Woman by Brian Azzarello from 2011, volume one, which is called Blood. Now, I have not read this yet, so I'm actually looking forward to reading this for the podcast. It's a different way of doing things, but I think it'll work out.
I think that's a great idea, and it's a great choice.
All right, let's play the end tag. You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at the Daddy Elk Productions handle @DaddyElk and use the hashtag #CollectedEdition. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
All right. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Until next time, say goodbye, Brian.
Say goodbye, Brian.
Excellent. And that's how we're going out. We'll be right back. led, of course, by Quentin Harderman. They come up with... I'll let you go.
Quentin Harderman.
No, I'm gonna save all this. I'm gonna save all this so that every time I make a joke, I'm just gonna play you laughing.
Quentin Harderman. Oh, okay.
Okay, Brian. Jeez.
I'm sorry. Okay, I'm coming back. Okay. Oh, I am a 10-year-old boy.
Yes.
So yes, Quentin Harderman. Just go on. Do I need to take the microphone out for a minute?
Oh, no.